Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Hi, this is Gene Sally.
And Maciej Halasz.
And we're a Linux Link Radio show. This is year number two, I believe. I think this is the first episode of next year's.
Wow.
And of course, we're recording this in November? No.
New era.
So this is year number two. So thanks a lot for listening in. You know, it's TimeSys, so or you know what we got for a 1 year big celebration.
Yeah, we'll probably go out and celebrate right after the recording of this episode. But what we'll do today is we actually had a lot of feedback from...
Well, they bought us coffee.
I'm sorry?
They bought us coffee. That
was I have some right here.
They said it was special than the other coffee they normally get.
So what we'll do today is we'll change slightly the structure of our episode today based on the feedback that we've received from you. And thank you for all the support for... all the comments and ideas that you like to hear on. So today what we'll do is we'll begin with providing an update on what's new in open source. And given that a 2.6.24 kernel came out, we'll talk a bit about that. Then we'll focus on inter-process communication, I guess, right?
Well, no, we had a couple other this is a full host of whatever. So we want to talk about the kernel, mm-hmm. and then we wanted to talk about a little bit, even though I know you don't want to, we want to talk a little bit about GCC because they have a new release that just came out for them. So we'll do a drive-by on that. And then, even though you don't want to, but I did want to mention because we were at RTTEC. It's an R with a bunch of T's and E and a bunch of C's. RTEC, whatever show.
Well, you should remember you were there.
Yeah, I was there. So they actually uncheaped up and sent me out there for a week. And then we're going to be at Embedded World. You're going to be in Embedded World, and so we wouldn't mention that too.
Yeah.
So in where's Embedded World at?
Nuremberg, Germany.
Lucky dog.
Again, the main topic of our today's episode is inter-process communication. But before we jump into our main topic for today, we'll spend some time talking about what's new in the open source, and we'll focus on Linux kernel and on GCC.
Okay.
Well, I just wanted to say it like
that. Just sounds like rehearsed and planned.
No.
I don't want word to get around.
Planned? What's that? Okay. So the 2.6.24 Linux has been out for what, a week, 2 weeks, maybe
something like that.
And there's actually quite a few changes and improvements. One of those changes is the an improvement around CFS and. CFS stands for...
I don't like acronyms. Completely Fair Scheduler.
There you go. It's been improved for both performance and a footprint. Right now, the new implementation of CFS should be a bit faster. It's smaller for both uniprocessor and SMP.
Yeah, I heard they really cut down the SMP size.
Yeah, that's a huge improvement, well, especially for scheduler.
Yeah, a lot of folks use CFS too because that's the underpinnings for the real time, right? That's the so-called, started out as the tickless scheduler, and then no one understood what tickless meant. So they changed it to Completely Fair because everyone likes things that are fair, I think.
Yeah, so speaking about the tickless feature, there's another improvement there. It got into a kernel with 2.6.21 kernel release, mm-hmm. but right now it provides support for more architectures. Mm-hmm. And again, support for a tickless timer, it allows the kernel to disable timer interrupts for longer variable periods of times. So if you want to save on power, which applies a lot to embedded systems, right, where mm-hmm. you have battery-operated devices, you can use that feature to control the power consumption. Another enhancement in the Linux kernel has been introduced to wireless configuration and device drivers. There's been a new wireless stack that was merged, I think, with the release of 2.6.22 Linux kernel.
Yeah.
But that wireless stack has not been used up till now by too many device drivers.
Yeah,
just one.
It's been percolating out there for, I don't know, up to a year now. Mm-hmm. And it's now getting adopted. The driver list, and I know we wrote down the driver list, but the driver list is huge, the number of people that have now adopted that. And it's because before it was like the one proof of concept driver. I think it was the, you know, IW, FW, Wi-Fi, you know, the IWI, Wi-Fi. I think whatever, that was sort of like the proof of concept driver. And now a lot of other drivers I know have collapsed mm-hmm. in there as well. And I think they have probably the Orinoco in there and the Real Links, whatever they're calling the Orinocos now.
There's actually support for the Intel Pro Wireless 3945 ABG device, but you'll also find device drivers for a number of Broadcom chipsets.
Okay.
A Prism 54 SoftMac, a Marvell chipset, and also SDIO driver. Well, SDIO driver is important because there's a lot of devices out there, I mean, embedded systems that have SDIO port on the card, and a lot of wireless chipset vendors build their new radios in an SD form factor. So it's actually easy to integrate with embedded devices. So that's an interesting one.
Because, I mean, the rate of change out there in wireless land is incredible.
Yeah.
I think they've probably practically given up, right, making them in something you can cement on the board. And so they just figure you'll substitute rate of production time.
Yeah, and but to support actually successfully those wireless devices and maybe other devices in an SD card form factor, another subsystem has been improved. The support for the SPI SDIO and the MMC layer has been improved. Mm-hmm. That area of the Linux kernel has undergone one of the biggest transformation in its life. And from now on, it's hopefully going to support much better different SD form factor devices like Wi-Fi for sure, but Bluetooth adapters, maybe some GPS receivers, and a whole range of other devices that manufacturers can think of these days. So from there, we can jump to maybe USB.
Yeah, that's really cool, by the way. So falling back, and this I think is going to really important for a lot of embedded customers, and that is the SBA. I'm thinking SDIO because that's what I just talked about. But the USB devices system subsystem has been reworked so that whenever you plug something in, right, you get this notification out in user land, script runs, whatever, authorizes device, and then makes all these device things available to the kernel. And that has been changed for you to require authorization. I think the way it's initially set up is it requires authorization from root in order for the device. So if you're making something where you anticipate other folks to come plugging in and you want to have control over the USB devices that are available to your system, this new change out in this version of the kernel is very important in that it actually enables the framework for you to get control over the devices that are just automatically added to your system.
Right. So rather than allowing end users to plug in whatever device they want, you can control that a specific device can accept only certain range of devices.
Yeah.
Because in most cases, end users are not going to be operating as root.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it uses the USB has a device, a group and manufacturing, whatever else. It uses those kind of keys and the same sort of infrastructure that's already in place, but as in that extra layer of authentication, it really helps you make a secure system and a more commercial system, opposed to something that is just like a desktop willy-nilly. You can just sort of plug things in. Oh, we also want to, the other thing is there's a lot of changes going on in there with respect to virtualization, which is really, it's really cool to see that coming up. Yeah. And virtualization has its, has its cousin or maybe not even stepsister or something like that. But it's
there's a family.
Well, it's been floating around the kernel for a while is this notion of a container. And so that has been a little bit unstructured. But one of the things they did do to spin up a little more structures, they started associating the concept of a PID and a network namespace. Because when you get into like a containered system, it can, think about like a regular Linux system has one init, right? And more appropriately has one global process list.
Yep.
And when you get in a containered system, it's entirely reasonable to have three different process lists, right? Mm-hmm. And, so three different PID zeros, right? So there needs to be some sort of disambiguation. And I'm seeing, what's happening with the PID and the network namespaces is that as you do things like, clone a process as a result of doing a fork or something like that, it does a better job of associating the new PID with the proper namespace.
In other words, does it mean that I can have direct association between my application and the specific network namespace? If I have several namespaces defined in my system, I can explicitly define that this part of my application is going to use this namespace?
Basically. Hmm. Basically, it's a continuity sort of thing. It's the best way I can describe it. And I know we don't have a ton of time to talk about this, but in the few minutes, it's the best way I can describe it. It's the continuity. And at the same time, they also did more work on the task control groups, which is pretty cool. And that follows back to these changes that have been going on in this containerization system. Mm-hmm. And part of the container is creating what they call a task control group. I think they call them C groups. I think that's what all the kids these days are calling them, right? And so there's more accounting and a tighter job. Those have been tightened up quite a bit. It's actually pretty cool because I know that when you're working with a multi-process system, things like a task group is important. And where do you want to have, what CPU do you want to have associated with certain task group? And I did have my head, like I said, we don't have a ton of time, but I didn't have my head all the way around this, but there's a great document if you download under documentation, check out cpusets.txt. And I think it was pretty cool. We were getting ready for this and figuring, but we could probably spend a decent amount of time talking about CPU sets and what's happening in the kernel with respect to virtualization. Yeah. But there's a ton of activity happening there.
Yeah, that's a topic for probably a separate episode.
Yeah, and then the other thing, I guess I'm sorry to monopolize the to-do list, but I'm on a roll, so before I forget, is that they're also doing... this is sort of a gear switcher thing, but there's work actually now for Linux kernel markers that I think they're officially called static probing points. I think is what they're calling them. But before it was sort of these patches that were here the code was patched at different points and it was really undependable with respect to whether the kernel probe, the thing that where did the measurement would. So that's been sorted out, and at least there's some agreed upon places where they do measurement probing. And that's really going to make life easier for the different sort of kernel probing projects that are out there. LTT has had this concept for a while because we use LTT here, right, to figure out, and a lot of customers are figuring out what in the world's going on. So there's these probe sets. And just having that in the kernel, it's an engineer in such a way that it's not expensive if they're unused. I mean, that's really going to help people that are going to into that.
So we've talked so far about different enhancements in the Linux kernel. I'm going to, before we jump to the next topic, I will very quickly go through a list of new device drivers that have been added to a Linux kernel mainline with the release of the 2.6.24 kernel. And again, I'm not going to go through a complete list of device drivers. There is far more than
We can just list them out alphabetically and read each one.
Well, by the time I would reach the 15, probably people would turn off
click, Well, no, I checked, and this is just, I mean, this is, and I'm sorry to go, but this is common. You're certainly seeing Linux, the wake of device drivers are supported and updated, whatever, is incredible for every kernel release.
There are so many new devices that are coming out from different vendors that, well, to support them effectively in Linux, you need to have those device drivers, and having them integrated into a mainline is the best way to support them amongst different uses and different boards, different architectures. So on that note, in the graphics area, there's a support for a new driver for the Blackfin BF54X frame buffer device driver. There is a bunch of device drivers that have been added for SATA IDE interfaces. I'm just going to mention two. There's a driver for PATA CS5536, driver for Geode companion chip.
Oh.
And there's a driver for Freescale 3 gigabits per second SATA controllers. So that's what's in the mainline today.
So we're starting to see, I mean, we get a lot of VIA customers out there. So that's really great that there's decent PATA. SATA is, serial ATA, right? And so it's really great to see that kind of support, because that really makes x86 for VIA look like a reasonable platform for IO bound tasks where typically was not considered. So that's huge.
It is. And we've talked briefly about the wireless device drivers, but there are other wired network device drivers. There's a new device driver for the one of the latest Intel chipsets, PCI Express based 10 gigabits Ethernet adapters. There's a new driver for the E1000 driver.
Get out.
Yeah, there is one that supports, on PCI Express.
I mean, E1000, that's bread and butter, right?
Yeah.
It's a bread and butter gigabit controller.
And what also has been added with this release is a device tree aware EMAC driver, which is great for PowerPC solutions that have already adopted device tree approach. In the sound area, we have support for one of the Atmel DAC devices using Atmel's SSCs.
Okay.
And in the USB area, there's another driver for the USB-A UDC driver.
Okay.
For USB. And then there's a whole bunch of device drivers that have been added in the DVB section. So TV, camera. There's a Toshiba TCM825X VGA camera sensor driver. There's a couple of baseband tuners from MicroTune.
Oh, cool.
And there's a revamped version of one of the Conexant demodulators. There's an I2C area, support for the DaVinci I2C controller.
Yeah, you know, a lot of boards are coming out there that now support the DaVinci.
Yeah.
And I know, what's chip manufacturer?
Texas Instruments.
Thank you very much. That's a TI thing. And, you know, here we don't see a ton of support because, you know, TI never really had a lot of device support, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're really starting to get in there and starting to do decent device support.
Yeah.
I think they finally figured out if they support the devices, you know, maybe someone will then go with Linux for their chip.
So lastly, just wanted to mention that briefly, Bluetooth. There's a generic driver for Bluetooth SDIO and USB devices in the kernel mainline now. So if
we're talking USB over Bluetooth.
Bluetooth over USB.
Pardon me.
Yes.
Bluetooth over, sorry, I misspoke. Bluetooth over USB.
Or SD.
Oh, wow.
Interface. So, even the breadth of different devices that we see on the market today, those generic device drivers are a very good either starting point or way to adopt those devices in actual projects, actual devices that people work on.
Yeah. Well, you know what people run into is like, oh, you repeat yourself too much. But, you know, we do know a lot of customers will go in there and use the latest kernel. It's their thing. They go in the latest kernel so they can get a hold of all these device drivers so they don't have to backport them. Because if you look a lot of these, like a lot of the device drivers you'll see in this is in USB and in the wireless, what's happened is that they've updated the entire stack that these rest on.
Entire
so if you're trying to if you're trying to backport to an older kernel, forget about it. I mean, really, it doesn't make...
Oh, you can, but you're not going to rip the benefits of performance optimizations that community puts in place for new kernels, right?
Yeah.
You can always backport certain device drivers, but as you said, because the major subsystems are being reworked...
It's not just the device driver that's changing.
It's not only
changing.
The device driver.
Yeah, and I guess if we'll have to spend some time and see if anyone's interested in, diving into the virtualization, even if it's into the C groups and whatever else that's happened there, because there's interesting changes.
Yeah.
Hey.
Let's jump to your favorite topic.
I know. I'm a user land boy, right? So GCC came out with a new release.
Yeah. What version is it?
This is 4.2.3.
Wow.
So it's getting up there, right? And I went through, I'm a compiler junkie, nerd. I guess I'm a nerd, right? But who likes compilers. So it's actually pretty cool what, and they've had some minor changes. They got in there and they changed around the overflow semantics.
Because
before you could, and if you write a loop like this, someone should come by and smack you anyway. But if you wrote a for loop that basically depended upon the variable to wrap to turn negative to terminate the loop.
Ouch. nice optimization.
Some people do that, right? So some people do that, right? They'll do a better job of discovering that and warning you with the strict overflow warnings and whatever else.
So those are the default settings that you're talking about?
Well, there's actually the command line is F strict dash overflow and warn warn W strict dash overflow.
Okay.
And they have to it tells the compiler to assume whether overflow semantics. To pay attention to overflow semantics to figure out when it's generating code.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can write a certain kind of loop that the compiler will look at and say, oh, infinite loop. And instead of generating a counter that increments that does, it'll just say, well, true, right?
Yeah.
And if you have a for loop that says, hey, if something is greater than zero and it keeps incrementing the variable, and you do this such that the variable then is the, if you say greater than zero, and then once you reach the overflow value, the next increment flips the sign bit, right? You have a negative number, right? And which actually terminate your loop.
Yeah.
So, so the compiler will interpret that differently and decide whether it wants to generate, basically while true and just skip all that incrementing stuff. Cause it has to do memory fetches and everything to get that to happen potentially.
So, you're talking only about GCC, or you're also talking about other tools that are needed by a compiler when you build it?
This is all GCC.
GCC, okay.
Yeah, I'll make it easy.
Good.
If you want to dig into bin utils and everything else, that's We'll say okay, that.
Okay, so what else is new?
So then the other thing is there's a top level reordering. So before GeoGCC used to come in there and just reorder things at will. So if you just want to do something that generates ASM and you really depend on the order that things come out, you know, if you get rid of the stuff in the front, you're basically writing your own little loader for the program. You can fix up some things there. Other thing of interest, and this is one of those other, you know, evilness things, right? That, you know, some guy 15 years ago wrote, but there's now warning that the GCC is going to be changed to use C99 semantics for inline functions.
Interesting.
And that really, really matters because, you know, some people would do, you know, inlines and they wrote them, they even do something like extern and inline, which is like, why? And so a lot of that's been fixed up, right? And it's like the warning. And there's also another cool warning flag that you can set on finally for you to check for improper uses of address pointers, right? Oh. So if you like perform tests against address pointers and it'll come back and say, hey, you really want to do this?
Yeah.
Because some people actually, you know, make that mistake. And then other people that write self-modifying code, which right, actually need to do that.
Self-modifying code.
Well, you know.
What you're saying is that writing C programs right now is going to be a bit easier because you have some of the safety checks in the compiler. Yeah, there's
more safety checks in there. And the other thing that I guess is the C++ has a, you know, I know very few, not a lot of folks use C++ for their embedded target. But, you know, I was flipping through the changes for that. And the one thing that really caught my eye was the deprecation of the min and max operators in C++. So, you know, when you ever go in for the job interview and, you know, when you go into these and you sit across from some guy that looks like he hasn't bathed or whatever for a while, and then he quizzes you on like C++ minutiae, right? There are a couple undocumented operators in GNU's C++ that have to do with minimum and maximum.
Yeah.
And gone.
They're gone.
Yeah. So finally,
it's easy to get a job these days.
Well, the thing is that you no longer have to explain what they do because they're deprecated.
Right.
that's the big difference. And there's also, you know, they also introduced, and it's interesting that it's only, I read it, but you know, I didn't have the chance to check before I came in here for C++, but for regular C, but there's also finally a warning in C for someone that produces an if statement without any following. Because there's some folks that do ifs that but produce side effects. They terminate and they have no action, right? So you say if and it's true, and then there's a block or expression that follows. There's some people, there's folks that would just write if blank, and they'll write out an expression and terminate it. So that's something that's been fixed so that if you write something that's like, you know, if one semicolon, you can have a warning set up to say, hey, you made a boo-boo.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's pretty. I mean, there's some really interesting things that are going on there in the standard, you know, C++ library. I know just a lot of people don't touch on those. Yeah. And there's some visibility issues too with respect to how C++ gets in there and determines what templates it binds to what functions. And that in itself is, it's almost like an exercise in understanding time travel, working out the C template binding.
So we spent quite a lot of time, I guess, talking about what's new in the open source, given all the new releases that happened. But the primary topic for today's episode
was... Yeah, we blew it, I think, because I think we have... Officially, if we follow the format, you know, if we go too long, people are not going to listen. So, but
I'm going to hear that on YouTube probably one day.
Well, you know what they're like. I mean, the people that look at the end is like, "Well, it's 40 minutes." And
yeah. Well, so let's start at least this topic, and we can continue it next time. Hopefully, we'll have less in terms of updates. What's an open source community, and we'll be able to focus a bit more on the primary topic. But
well, you soaked up all the time with the kernel update.
Well, okay,
you did.
My fault. Okay, so the inter-process communication.
Yeah, we want to talk about IPC.
Yeah. Last time we talked about what it takes to write a new device driver, and we've talked about how you communicate with the device driver from a user land. I don't think that there's a single application these days, that's deployed in a real product that would not use at least one of the IPC models.
Yeah. You know, it's a common problem for embedded people to solve, and there's all kinds of different There's all kinds of different tricks in the bag with Linux. And one of the neat things about Linux is that people call in and say, well, I have something that uses, you know, semaphores. Do you have semaphores? And so you always have that. But so we did want to talk about some basic IPC sort of mechanisms. We have I guess I mentioned semaphores, pipes, message queues, and signals.
Mm-hmm.
Mutexes are in there too,
yeah,
which are worth talking about. But I know when we were getting ready for this, we thought, well, I don't know, because mutexes really are a thread sort of thing rather than a process sort of thing.
It is a synchronization object.
But it mostly is a synchronization. No doubt that it's a synchronization object.
So when you talk about inter-process communication and Linux, and I guess most of the operating systems, there are different standards that describe how the inter-process communication should behave. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's two big standards out there. You have the System 5, yeah, right?
That's been in Linux for a while.
Oh my goodness, yeah. And then you also have what's out there from POSIX.
POSIX.
And POSIX is, POSIX has been supported in various incarnations since the beginning of Linux. That's one of the things. I mean, the POSIX standard shifts, and then the semantics behind what things do also has shifted around.
And what also actually has changed is, well, not that much API, but the implementation of that API has been revamped over the past few, I would say years now.
Oh, yeah.
For different POSIX mechanisms to make them very efficient and to enable end users with writing the applications exactly the way they want.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that we can talk about, for example, message queues or signals, because there have been some of updates.
Yeah, those are two interesting things. I always think, so if you think about a message queue, a lot of folks, they sort of get involved and they're like, well, okay, I need to pass messages, so maybe I should use one of these message queue things. And when you set up a message queue, it's a object that's created that's actually a device node. I mean, it'll actually make a file node in the system, and it creates one of these, and you sign in a name. And then you have a couple different objects will then go and open up the same message queue. And I shouldn't say objects, a couple different processes, each will open up the same message queue. Mm-hmm. And then the kernel provides a buffered environment, a buffered and synchronized environment for this message queue. So you can have one process that's, as a matter of fact, let's go to this. You can have multi-readers and multi-writers. That's the one neat thing about message queues. It doesn't matter how many connections you have for read or write. The operating system will then figure out, will then perform the correct queuing and then, just let someone answer the message queue when it's ready.
Is it synchronous, asynchronous?
Well, you can set them up to be either synchronous or asynchronous with respect to, whether the call releases, right?
Blocking.
Where the call blocks on return. So, if you wanted to have like a typical reader process set up, you could just have it do a blocking read and it just sort of sits there, right? And then whenever a write occurs on the pipe, whenever the write completes, one of the readers, like the first reader in the queue, in fact, will get that message. And then the next reader somehow gets bumped forward. It's an implementation detail as to what happens.
Yeah. So I know that you spent quite some time playing with message queues. And I always kind of wanted to ask you this question. How large is the queue?
Interesting. So it is something you've set. At kernel time, at kernel compilation time, you fix the size of the queue, the number of queues your system is allowed to have, the number of messages it's allowed. In essence, the size of the queue is the depth of the queue times the size of the message. Right? Fairly easy math. Right?
Say it again.
The size of the queue times the size of the depth. I'll use computer science terms. The depth of the queue times the maximum depth times the size of the message, and a little bit of overhead.
Okay.
You're shaking your head.
Well.
I know because I corrected myself like 7 times. Just try one time. Depth of the queue times size of the message.
Okay, that's how big the message queue is.
Correct.
Okay. Got it.
And and one of the things about that, Maciej, is that you can run into situations where you can get into failure modes in your system because you have to plan that out ahead of time. Mm-hmm. If you run into one of those, I'm going to beat up on my system, right? So you have the QA engineer comes in who wants to make a name for himself, right? And so what he does is he floods your system, right?
Yeah.
Well, you can easily get into very interesting breaking situations because what will happen is the reads will sometimes block, depending on if you have a blocking read, right? So your read will block until the queue frees up. Right. But while you have that blocking read, rest of your processes, your process is coming to a halt, right? Yeah. So you can get into some real interesting synchronization problems and real interesting throughput problems whenever you begin to hit the maximum size of your queue. And then if you do like non-blocking, if you're not careful and you check for that condition because you actually needed to come back and do a rewrite,
So what you're saying is that one message queue can handle both blocking and unblocking messages?
Yeah.
So the question then bears, should you mix the two?
You know what? Maybe. I could easily see a blocking reader and a non-blocking writer process. That's fine. I guess here's the fundamental thing. Here's what my years of doing this stuff, mostly unsuccessfully, right? So the key to doing this is to not have your message queue, your POSIX message queue, serve as a queue, right? So the real trick to doing this is to have the reader side set up to read off and put whatever data it needs into whatever internal processing queue inside your process. Because I think if you get in the situation where your message queue behaves as a data storage mechanism, you will get into all manner of problems.
What happens when your message queue is full?
Depends if you're blocking or non-blocking, right?
Well, so, to a writer, to an attempt to write another message to that queue.
So if you're a blocking writer, it'll block till the queue opens. And if you're a non-blocking writer, it'll come back, right? The error code. It'll come back with -1. Yeah, it'll come back with a -1 error, and then it'll set error no.
Okay.
To whatever, to like E again, I think is what it
so
comes back with.
So you can nicely control whether you can write or not to that particular queue.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is like you still run into the situation where you're almost double buffering, right? Because if your process job is to write into the queue and then get something else, your loop now has become another edge of complexity.
You have to keep it locally.
It needs to keep looping through there until it gets a successful message. And then if you're not properly queuing up the data before you dump it into the queue, you could have...
When would you use message queues?
Well, whenever you have a structured bit of information, you know, a known quantity of information to send to another process.
Okay, so if you want to exchange information that has certain structure, as defined probably by both processes.
Yeah, so everyone knows the structure of the data that's being passed, and it's something atomic, right? So each message in and of itself is a complete chunk of information.
So it's not a single flag that you flip. It's actually the information that can be used by another process to change the behavior of the application.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's the right pattern. What you see a lot of people doing is they'll put some time into writing a little bit of code that serializes some structure. And serialize means just to turn into a big text string, hopefully not XML, because otherwise you'll need to definitely resize your message queue, right? But they'll take a data structure or something and they'll turn it into turn it into text that's acceptable to be placed on the queue that's fairly compact. And that'll get picked up on the other side of the queue and then put into the same data structure.
And you can convert to whatever information you need.
Yeah.
I think that we are being flagged here that we are out of time. We have a couple of other synchronization objects that we haven't touched upon yet. So let's leave it for next time.
Yeah, next time we'll put some time and we'll talk about signals and semaphores, which everyone loves signals and semaphores, right? I mean, that's one of the first things you get into Linux or whatever kind of stuff and you try signals out. So.
Well, and this is, I guess, one of the basic topics when you learn about synchronization at the university or at school, regardless of what operating system implements, you kind of get to know what semaphore and signals should be capable of. So next time when we talk about how they are implemented in Linux and what you can do with them, hopefully that's going to also help a bit in how you think about your application implementation.
Yeah, we should cover that. Oh, and I guess the thing to mention is like I said, we're going to be in embedded world. I think booth 11-113, February 26th through 28th in Nuremberg.
That's pretty easy to remember. Again, booth number 11-113.
Yeah. And so Maciej is going to be there, so you can hang out and talk to Maciej. I'm sure he'd be happy to throw to death to talk to you. I know we have a lot of listeners in Europe.
Yes, absolutely. So please stop by. I've never been to that show, so I don't know what the traffic is going to be like. But if I'm there, stop by and that'd be very nice to talk to you.
Yeah, and I know we're also at the RTECC. Someone put a big piece of paper in front of my face saying, get it right this time. But so we're at the RTECC show and in Silicon Valley. And I know there's another one in Dallas.
So that's where you're going.
So you get to go to Nuremberg. I get to go to soulless Dallas for God's sake. So I'll be off in Dallas for, I think for a couple of days. I think it's like a one day show there.
And again, if you have any comments or suggestions, questions, please do contact us, send us emails. We get quite a few of them these days, and we do our best to respond back to them. But send them to podcast@timesys.com mm-hmm. or visit us at timesys.com.
Yeah. You know, they finally got this, linuxlinkradio.com.
And there's another URL, yeah, linuxlinkradio.com. Yeah,
visit Linux, I can say it, linuxlinkradio.com.
There you go. Well, so till next time, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, thanks, bye.
Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.